It is a brisk, cold day here on the west coast of Florida. My name is Joel Tillis. This is the Soul Trap. Well, today we're going to be talking about intruders. Intruders from another realm? Yes. Intruders from another dimension? Yes. Intruders from beyond the veil? I believe yes. In September 1983, UFO investigator Bud Hopkins received a letter from Kathy Davis, a letter that would trigger a 2.5-year investigation into certain extraordinary events at her home in Copley Woods. The investigation would involve the skills of psychologists, radiologists, chemists, and even medical practitioners. It would test the beliefs, the faith, and in fact the very sanity of everyone involved. And ultimately, it would provide the most significant evidence to date that not only are reports of the abduction of humans by aliens true, but that there is a specific and profoundly disturbing purpose behind such abductions. I just read to you the inside introductory flap to a book written by Bud Hopkins called Intruders, The Incredible Visitation at Copley Woods. I think when we think about alien abductions, there is a lot of different information and misinformation. But I think we all have to ask ourselves the question, could it be that stories like these, seemingly a million miles from reality, the stuff more of movie fantasy than real life, could it be that in actual reality they are real? Can you even define what you mean when you use the term real? Real to what? Real to your senses? Well, if your sensory observation, your empirical data is the limitation of your real world, then the spiritual world certainly is not real to you. But alas, we as believers know that there is more than simply what can be observed with senses alone. What is real? Is real something you can categorize, trivialize, synthesize, and force feed into the computation system of personal bias and experience? What if below the surface there is a growing, swelling number of people, not just people, but people groups, being directly conditioned to receive one day in the near future the arrival, the appearance of the star gods once again, as in the days of Noah? I do not think that Bud Hopkins is some kook. For 12 years, Bud Hopkins was actually a skeptical, meticulous investigator of UFO reports. He has written books like Missing Time and others that have been heralded as highly scientific in their investigation of the issue. He graduated from Oberlin College. He's a sculptor. He has received a National Endowment of the Arts Fellowship, a John Simon Guggenheim Fellowship. His work is shown in galleries as a painter and a sculptor, museums around the country. And the fact of the matter is, he has been involved in the scientific work and psychological study of this phenomenon for some time to come. Now, whether you're a physicist or a housewife or a UFO researcher or simply a dabbler in the occult, one of the things about the book Intruders is that it will indeed strain the credulity, the breaking point, as the book itself says, of your belief system. In fact, the book states the human mind often cannot accept or even vividly imagine an unrealistic or deeply unpalatable truth. Though we can entertain almost any wild idea in theory, a profoundly unsettling concept can be almost impossible to really believe, despite the weight of evidence and the pressure of logic. One particular Minnesota UFO abduction victim wrote the following. For most of us, it began with the memories, though some of us recalled parts of all of our experiences. It was more common for us to have to seek them out where they were, buried in a form of amnesia. Often we did this through hypnosis, which was, for many of us, a new experience. We felt terrified as we relived these traumatic events, a sense of being overwhelmed by their impact. But there was also a disbelief. We often felt crazy. We continued our search for the real explanation of our troubles. We tried to figure out what was wrong with us that these images were surfacing. Why is my mind doing this to me? We would ask. Many of our friends were skeptics, of course, and though it hurt us not to be believed, what could we expect? What would we do if we were in their place? Many were rigid in their denial of even the slightest possibility of abductions. We felt caught in the prison of a vicious circle that seemed to be imposed on us as abductees by a skeptical society. Why do you believe you were abducted? You believe it because you're crazy. How do we know you're crazy? Because you believe you're abducted. We felt the pain of being different, as though we were only passing for normal. Some of us came to the difficult realization that there was no one with whom we could be our complete selves, and that felt like a pretty lonely place to be. Abduction cases are an unusual thing. They are a spiritual thing, I think, and they are something that is growing at a very large scale below the surface. Beyond Trump and Pelosi, beyond the wall and Russia, beyond China and North Korea, and all of the things that seem to be at the forefront of the news, I believe that there is a growing, subtle, below the surface, yet tectonic in its power and pressure, group of people that are experiencing something. Intruders from the other side. Now, Bud Hopkins, as a researcher, feels the same way. I'm going to read to you a little passage from his book. I suggest that you get it yourself. I think you'll find it to be a fascinating read. But we pick up with Bud Hopkins in his book, chapter number one. He states, "The Betty and Barney Hill case gave us the first inkling of what was to become a flood of similar abduction reports, straining our credulity even further. I had had a daylight UFO sighting in 1964, an event that generated my interest in the subject, and yet, when I read the detail of the Hills' encounter, I could not accept the idea that such a thing as an abduction by UFO occupants was possible. Using Justice Frankenfurter's distinction, it was not that I thought the Hills were lying, it was that I just could not believe them. My own subsequent investigations of similar UFO sightings, however, slowly and inexorably led me to accept the possibility that abduction encounters might literally be occurring as described. As the evidence mounted and case report followed case report, I became convinced of the importance of this aspect of the UFO phenomenon, and by 1977 concentrated my efforts in this area of research. The result in 1981 was the publication of my book on the subject. Eventually, Kathy Davis's recognition, while she read it, of certain patterns and details that applied to herself and her family would come to fruition. One of the central ideas in Missing Time, my book, was my guess that many people, perhaps thousands, may have had UFO abduction experiences and yet consciously remember almost nothing to indicate they had suffered these traumatic encounters. The pattern of evidence we had uncovered suggests that a kind of enforced amnesia can efficiently erase from conscious memory all but the very slightest recollections of such experiences. In one of the seven similar cases we investigated, Stephen Kilburn described nothing more than a deep-seated fear of a certain stretch of highway and his feeling that something had happened to him there that possibly involved a UFO. Unlike Betty and Barney Hill, he did not recall sighting a UFO. He was not aware of any missing time or even seeing anything unusual. But after investigation, his case, with the help of Ted Blosher, two psychologists and a polygraph operator, I came to the conclusion that his sketchy, though emotionally loaded, initial recollection did in fact conceal a full-blown UFO abduction experience. Under hypnosis, Steve relived a traumatic encounter very similar in its detail to the Hill case. A second extremely important pattern emerged from these early investigations, a pattern which the Copley Woods affair would amply illustrate. It appears that most UFO abductees have had more than one such experience, their first abduction generally occurring in childhood, around the age of 6 or 7. Often they are picked up and examined several times after that, though these later encounters are rarely reported past the age of 40 or so. An analogy which immediately springs to mind is the human study of endangered animals, in which zoologists tranquilize and tag or implant transmitters in sample animals to trace their subsequent wanderings. I presented evidence in my book indicating a similar interest by UFO occupants in certain human beings who are apparently treated like experimental subjects, requiring re-examination at intervals across the years. And, as we shall see, there is evidence that these human subjects have also been somehow tagged. The third point dealt with the issue of the still-visible scars, which apparently resulted from the UFO occupants' systemic, quasi-medical examination of three people when they were first abducted as children. In the illustrations section, I reproduced three photographs of these small, straight scars as they currently appear, respectively on the back of the calf, above the knee, and on the hip of three different abductees. As in the Hill case, hypnosis was used to break the memory blocks and to elicit descriptions of the surgical procedures which caused the cuts, as well as detailed recollection of the occupants' physical appearance and the interiors of the UFOs themselves. Though we do not have any indication of the purpose of these incisions, their physical character suggests cell sampling of some kind. Over the past 5 years, I have encountered 27 more abductees who bear similarly acquired scars, though a number of these marks are of different type. Instead of a short, straight cut, 7 are circular, shallow depressions, scoop-like marks, one might say, about 1/4 to 1/2 inch in diameter. The photographs I reproduced in Missing Time gave Kathy Davis yet another reason to write me. She, her mother, and her closest friend, and her next-door neighbor all bear nearly identical scars on their lower legs, all apparently resulting from earlier UFO abduction experiences. Though Kathy mailed her letter in August, it was not forwarded to me by the publishers until September. She told me later that while she was reading the book, she had begun to realize that herself had had many of the same partial memories, UFO abduction dreams, and disturbing mental flashbacks as the individuals I described. The effect of it all had been extremely unsettling, though in her initial communication, she decided not to refer to her own deepening anxiety. Because of a personal reticence that I soon recognized as one of Kathy's basic qualities, she preferred to tell me about other things first. When I opened her letter, some 15 color photographs spilled out. I recognized, of course, immediately a familiar image from UFO, quote, landing trace investigations, a circular area of ground in which all the grass appears to be dead, as if it had been subject to heat or to some other form of radiation. Ted Phillips, an investigator who is particularly interested in this kind of report, has cataloged over 1,200 cases in which UFOs apparently have physically affected their surroundings. Many of the photographs in his files, such as those taken of the site shortly after a UFO was observed, on or just above the ground near Delphos, Kansas, closely resemble Kathy's enclosures. But even more important, later analysis of the affected soil in both cases showed that the degree of calcification of soil dehydration was similar and equally difficult to account for. Kathy began her letter by explaining that there were two things she wanted to inform me about: the event documented in the photographs and a missing time incident that occurred years before involving her older sister. She wrote first about the more recent incident. Kathy's letter. Around the first week of July, 1983, at about 8 to 9 p.m., I was preparing to go out and sew a little at a neighbor's home, and while I was standing at the kitchen window, I noticed a light in the pool house, and the door was open. I remembered distinctly shutting it earlier, so I knew it shouldn't be open, let alone have the light on, so I mentioned it to Mom. She looked and wondered what was up, but neither one of us were at all alarmed. When I got ready to leave, I decided to drive around and turn around and make sure no one was out there, as Mom would be alone with the kids, my son Rob, who was 4, and Tommy, 3. When I did, the light was off, and the door shut, and the garage door was open, which I found to be even stranger. When I got to Deanne's house, one street over, I called Mom and told her what I saw and asked if she'd like me to come home and check it out. She sounded rather nervous, not like Mom at all. She said she had seen a big light by the pool house and that it moved up to the bird feeder and grew to about 2 feet in diameter. But she didn't see any beam. It was just like a spotlight on the bird feeder, lighting it up, but nothing else around it. When I got there, it was gone, and I took the time to look all around the property. I did finally find my dog, hiding under a car out back. Usually she carries on something fierce when anyone she doesn't know is on our property. It's not like her to hide and have to be coaxed out from anywhere, especially by me. She's usually all over me. I didn't see anything that night. So I went back to sew, and later that night, Dee and I and her daughter came back about midnight and went swimming. Right after that night, our yard was burned by what we do not know. Nothing will grow there now. No matter how much water we give it, and wild animals won't go on it either. Even my dog. At first, even Penny would walk halfway around the yard to avoid walking on it. She'd sniff it and run the other way. Birds will no longer go near the bird feeder either, and we have always had tons of birds every day, especially redbirds. Well, that's the story of our backyard mystery. It's still here for anyone who wants to see it, more or less unchanged. Now, I pause from the reading of the book for a moment to say, what possible motive does this lady have for writing Bud Hopkins? Well, you say she may want to write to make sure that she gets her story and her 15 minutes of fame, but does that really seem like she's looking for fame? And is that really the kind of fame that people want? It almost appears as if she's telling you a true-to-life story. Hopkins goes on to write, when taken together, several things Kathy mentioned in her account of the strange backyard lights and the dead area on the lawn suggested to me the possibility that a UFO landing had taken place despite the fact that neither she nor her mother remembered having seen anything that could be called a craft. The unusual behavior of her dog is typical of many UFO sighting reports in which dogs, horses, and even cattle seem to be dramatically affected by low-level or landed UFOs. This phenomenon, it has been theorized, may be a reaction to disturbing sound frequencies outside the range of human hearing. Often, the animal continues for a time to be wary of the site where the disturbance took place. The small moving lights that Kathy's mother described have also been mentioned many times before in conjunction with low-level UFO sightings. But the photographs, of course, presented the most graphic evidence in support of Kathy's claim of a drastic, nearly overnight change in the Davis's lawn. The main area was a circle 8 feet in diameter in which all grass had turned brown and was now crumbling away. Now, I want to digress for just a moment. It is very interesting that Jesus was able to curse a fig tree, and that fig tree withered away in the sight of the disciples. It makes you wonder if there is not a specific peculiar power that eternal dimensional beings have that we do not have. And if in some way this kind of manifestation of alter-dimensional beings is what's causing this disruption to the natural relative environment around them. But Hopkins goes on to write, this long track record ended in a nearly perfect arc and seemed absolutely artificial. Two smaller jogs appeared to emerge from the main circle, and one of these contained a deep crack, which looked superficially, as if it had been caused by intense heat. The photographs were clear and effectively showed the mysterious damage, but Kathy had still another story to tell. Her letter continued. Now about Laura, my sister Laura. Laura is 35 years old. She's always been very level-headed and not much imagination. Always the realist in the family. Anyway, in the summer, about 1965, she left one evening, about 4:30 p.m., to take my mother to bingo. On the way home from dropping her off as she was passing the church on 10th Street, she suddenly was strangely compelled to pull into the church parking lot around back. She noticed there weren't any cars around and thought it quite strange for a Sunday afternoon in that busy area. When she parked, she looked up and saw something she'd never believed before then. It was silver, and I believe she said the lights were red, green, and white, flashing somewhat. Flickering might be a better word, and let me digress. You might want to read some of the descriptions of Ezekiel. It was hovering soundlessly over the lot, about telephone pole high, right above her car. All she remembers now is she reached over to turn down her radio to see if it made a noise. And then the next thing she remembers, it is dark out. She looks up and this thing is gone, and she's driving down the street. When she went to get Mom that night, they drove around looking for it, but she never saw it or anything like it again. Hopkins states in this brief account of her sister's 1965 experience, Kathy includes three intriguing details that turn up frequently in abduction accounts. First, there is a suggestion of external control over the abductee. One simply finds oneself compelled, as Kathy put it, to drive down a particular road, enter a parking lot, leave one's house, or whatever, for no apparent reason. The decision is remembered as odd, even irrational, and frequently a witness will say something like, I didn't even know there was a road there, but I found myself turning off the main route to drive down it. I stopped next to the field, and there was a UFO hovering above the trees. No one knows how this seeming psychic control is enforced, but it is a basic component to many UFO abduction reports. The potential abductee is apparently set up in a place that permits the UFO and its occupants to operate efficiently, safely, secretly. So far, all the UFO abduction cases I have investigated have had this kind of tactical plausibility, a fact that weighs in on the side of their physical reality. The second and more crucial indication of a possible UFO abduction was the fact that Laura, quote, lost a period of time. First, it was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and the next thing she knew, it was several hours later since darkness had fallen. One common characteristic of an abduction experience is the merging in memory of its onset and its conclusion, a joining so seamless as to leave the abductee with no feeling that he or she has actually lost any time, despite what clocks and simple vision may establish beyond any doubt. This partial and apparently externally imposed amnesia, or I will personally say, the possibility of them entering into a different dimensional realm not bound by the spatial limitations of our own time realm, can be extremely effective. Laura remembered sitting in her car and looking up at the UFO, but her very next recollection after that was of driving down a street with the UFO no longer in sight. It is significant that she reported these odd recollections to her mother that very evening in 1965, at least a year before the public at large was aware of the symptoms or even the existence of such bizarre events. The third indication of a possible abduction was, of course, the presence of the telephone pole measuring the height the context of the UFO itself. In fact, the UFO was the actual centerpiece to her recollection. But there was more. In Missing Time, I had described the use of hypnosis in recovering forgotten details in such cases, and I had recounted some of the vagaries of both the method and its results, as it had been employed by various psychiatrists and psychologists who aided our investigation. Kathy's letter continued bringing up an event that, in this context, was very particularly interesting. For now, we'll have to leave Mr. Hopkins and the intruders there. We'll come back and pick up with the strange case of Copley Woods, the intruders, and what exactly Kathy uncovered.